This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we caught up with an education reporter at WFYI to talk about her new story on police working in Indiana schools. We're joined by Lee Gaines, investigative education reporter at WFYI, to talk about a new story out today about police officers working in Indiana's schools. Welcome, Lee, to the program. So glad to have you on with us today.
Happy to be here.
The story that you have out is about the training that officers go through or don't go through to work in schools. Can you tell us what the issue at the core of the story is?
So the core of this story is that there are officers in the state of Indiana and nationally that believe police who are working in schools should have specialized training, and that this is essentially a specialized position, much like being a detective or a member of a SWAT team is. And so they say it's unreasonable to expect that someone who came out of the police academy is able to function well and appropriately within a school setting if they don't have this special training.
And when you came across this story and you reported on it, how did you find it?
So I wound up talking to someone named Chase Lyde. He is the head of the Indiana School Resource Officer Association. And it was interesting because the way that this is codified in Indiana law is it looks like all police working in schools have to undergo this 40-hour training. And what he told me is that that's not true. And it's actually something that he's been lobbying for from lawmakers for the last few years or so. So to explain that, basically what's happening is that if you want to be called a school resource officer, then you are required to go through a 40-hour basic SRO training from the National Association of School Resource Officers, NASRO for short, or another approved program. But here's the thing, police officers can work inside schools without this training so long as they don't call themselves school resource officers.
Oh, that's interesting. So they can call themselves just police officers?
Yeah, they're just police officers working in schools. And so if they're just police officers working in schools, then they're not required under Indiana law to have any specialized training.
I'm curious, does that mean, like, so do schools have to have school resource officers or do they have police in their place?
They don't have to have SROs. There was a grant program, or there is a grant program managed by the Indiana Department of Homeland Security, which previously, if you wanted to get grant funding from the state to employ a police officer in your school, they had to be an SRO. And so you had to have that training. You had to be certified as an SRO. That program was changed very recently, I believe in the last year or so, so that schools can request grant money to have either an SRO or just a police officer in their school. So if they're just a police officer in the school, they're not required to have that training. And the justification for that change, I was told by a spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security, is that they wanted to get police into schools in more rural areas where there might not be a trained school resource officer available.
So I'm just trying to think. So if they want police to come in rural areas, couldn't they just train them to be SROs?
They could, but the training it's a 40-hour training. It covers 5 days a week, and it's not free, but they could do it. And I think this is what Chase is really frustrated by and wants to change. He wants to make this mandatory, not just for, you know, quote unquote school resource officers, but for any police officer working in a school in the state of Indiana. He wants them to go through this training, basically saying it's really necessary in his opinion and the opinion of other people who are school resource officers.
When it comes to the training, what kind of training are we talking about? You said it's about 40 hours. What does it entail?
So it covers, so this is the NASRO training, the National Association of School Resource Officer training. So it covers how to interact with students with disabilities, things like the ethics of school policing, counseling and mentoring. So basically how to be an informal counselor and mentor to students, how social media works, how the team brain develops. This is something that, you know, I talked to Chase a lot about, which is basically teaching officers about, you know, the adolescent brain development and why adolescent behaviors or child behaviors might be different than that of adult behaviors, trauma in children, so adverse childhood experiences, how that impacts brain development and how children show up in a classroom, how to spot the signs of sex trafficking, school-related laws, also how to identify racial biases and foster and retain relationships with diverse and marginalized students, as well as trends in drugs, crime prevention, and then things like emergency preparedness. And so the course is taught in a classroom, although I'm unsure how it's been done in the pandemic. They have PowerPoint presentations, you know, videos and practical scenarios. And basically the students are given a test. And at the end of that, they have to get a score of 70% or higher to earn this certificate to be a school resource officer.
Is this available for non-police folks who want to be a school resource officer? And it sounds remarkable. The training sounds like something everybody could use.
Yeah, I think there are other types of training that you can get. But my understanding is this is specifically for sworn law enforcement officials who work in schools in any capacity. So it's building on law enforcement training that they previously had in the academy. The whole argument that's being made here by the advocates for this training is that, yes, like, you need to learn how to be a police officer, and that's why everyone goes to a police academy. But in order to work inside a school setting, you also need to know all of these other things as well.
Well, what about the folks that are not proponents of this training? Or, I mean, are there any folks that don't think it's necessary?
So I've talked to a couple lawmakers about this who have worked with LIDE, and basically they tried to pass some legislation over the last couple of years, and that legislation either died in committee or didn't get very far. And so one of the concerns that I've heard is this fear that if you start mandating training like this, training that isn't free, it costs about $450 to $500 per officer, although there are, you know, discounts if agencies want to train a large number of them. But basically that if you start mandating this, then you're going to ultimately decrease the number of police in schools, which is something that the lawmakers I talked to are concerned about and other people who opposed this mandatory requirement were concerned about.
Are they following any sort of model or evidence from other states that have done this?
So it's interesting because the approach to policing in schools, from what I can tell in my reporting, is kind of all over the place. So there are about 28 states across the country that have some statutory requirement for training, but it varies pretty extensively. Like, it could be, you know, they're only required to do active shooter training or something along those lines. So there really isn't like consistency across the nation or a model to hold up across the nation about how police and schools should operate. You know, it should be important to note here for context that the number of police in schools has dramatically increased over the last decade, from, you know, 1% of schools reporting a police officer in their buildings in the 1970s to more than half in 2018. And as the number of police in schools has risen, largely in response to concerns around mass shootings, there hasn't been, you know, associated legislation catching up with that rise in the number of police officers. So you see a piecemeal approach, not only in the state of Indiana, but across the country.
And when it comes to lawmakers who are pushing or fighting against it, are there any specific lawmakers that have spoken out?
Not that I'm aware of. I talked to Representative Bob Boehning and Senator Jeff Rotz about this, and this is actually something they support. Something that Jeff Rotz told me is that he wants to have some consistency in the statutes about how police in schools operate and what training is or is not required. He told me he needs to do more research on the subject. And Representative Bob Boehning also told me that this is something that he would support, but it's a matter of convincing other people, their colleagues in the Senate and the House, that this is something worth pursuing.
Have you heard of any consequences that might happen if officers don't go through the SRO training?
This is something that I asked Chase, as well as the head of the National Association of School Resource Officers. His name is DJ Sheff. He's also an SRO in the Carmel Clay District. And basically what Sheff told me is that he is very concerned about an increase in arrests of students and an increase in altercations, physical altercations between police officers and schools and students, as well as lawsuits against school districts because of something that a police officer in the school did. And so that's something that they're really concerned about and why they want to have this training. I think it's also important for our listeners to know that up until the 2018-19 school year, arrests were increasing since 2016 in Indiana schools. They dropped slightly in the 2019-2020 year, which I think is to be expected because of school closures during the pandemic, but they didn't drop by that much.
Right, right. Well, when it comes to this topic, has the State Department of Education made any action or comment about it?
Yeah, so another thing that's important for our listeners to understand is that the Indiana Department of Education just recently partnered with the National Association for School Resource Officers, NASRO, to provide this 40-hour basic SRO training in regions of the state that they say are underserved with trained SROs. And they told me that that ranges from rural to urban and everywhere in between, and that the state will fund training for up to 180 officers over the next 2 years. But the spokesperson I spoke to at the Indiana Department of Education says they're still in the process of figuring out what regions of the state are actually underserved, because another important thing to note here is no one is tracking how many officers in schools have or have not received this training. And so this is something that Sheff with NASRO and Carmel Clay Schools was really happy about, this partnership with the Indiana Department of Education. He says it sends the message that this kind of training is valuable and important, but he and Lyde still believe that state lawmakers need to take action to correct this problem and mandate the training across the board.
Do you think that there's going to be any movement on this, like the next legislative session?
I have no idea. We'll see. You know, that's something about being a reporter is, you know, I heard this, I was shocked by it because I thought the training was required. Turns out it's not. You know, I wanted to highlight it and explain what was going on and why people think this training is important. You know, it's one of those things about being a journalist. You just put the information out there. You really have no idea what people will do with it. You know, your whole positive change does result, though.
So we'll keep an eye on this. And thank you so much for doing this investigative report and coming on the program. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Lee Gaines is an investigative education reporter at WFYI. You can see her work at WFYI.com/news. We'll be back after a quick break with health experts to talk about the impact the Delta variant is having in Indiana and what's next for guidelines and mandates during the pandemic. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam So, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap, and it's the Friday recap, where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, we're going to hear from two health experts who will give us an update on the pandemic and the Delta variant's impact on Indiana so far. With us now are two guests, both from the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Shandy Dearth is director of the Center for Public Health Practice, and Thomas Dzinski is the director of Epidemiology Education. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, thanks for the opportunity.
Shandy, we'll get into the details throughout the rest of the show, but before we do, how is Indiana doing right now?
So unfortunately, we are starting to see cases increase. We are still doing contact tracing for Marion County, and at a low a few weeks ago, we were only seeing 25 or 30 cases a day. And unfortunately, we're heading towards that 200 a day. And the State Department of Health did announce today that they saw more than 1,600 cases over the last day. So unfortunately, we're trending in the wrong direction, and it looks like vaccinations have basically frozen. We're not making enough progress in that area.
Is it a possibility to even make progress if this variant is spreading so quickly to catch up with vaccinations at the rate that it's spreading?
It is, because unfortunately it could get a lot worse. I mean, this should be the red flag to go ahead and get vaccinated now if you have not been vaccinated yet. And so we're not in that dire situation yet, but we could be within a few weeks where we could start to see that surge on hospital systems. So that's why we really encourage everyone to go ahead and get vaccinated. If you've been vaccinated, let your friends and family know so they see that you've been vaccinated and everything's been fine. And it might help encourage them to get vaccinated as well.
Maybe we need those stickers like I voted, I got vaccinated.
Exactly. I actually saw those handed out at the site where I took my daughter to be vaccinated a few weeks ago. And I think it's just a great reminder to share that, to let people know that you're fine. You got vaccinated. You're able to move on and go back to what, you know, we used to think of as a normal life.
Absolutely. Well, Thomas, what are we seeing with the Delta variant? Is it having the impact you thought it would?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, at least looking here in Indiana, the Delta variant makes up about 87% of the cases that we're seeing currently in the state of Indiana. It's definitely something that is more infectious than what we've seen with other variants of this particular virus. And we're seeing, unfortunately, breakthrough disease of people that are vaccinated now. That I should note, though, that breakthrough disease is very mild. Generally doesn't have very strong signs or symptoms associated with it. And people that are vaccinated aren't being hospitalized and aren't dying like those that are unvaccinated at this point.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about the breakthrough cases, but I want to ask you about the variants. I know we've discussed this various times on our show, but mm-hmm. for listeners who may be listening for the first time, how do these variants pop up?
Sure. So you have to think of it. I often think of this as like the monks in the medieval ages, where they were copying books, right? So if a monk were copying a book and they made a mistake and that book got out and somebody else copied it, well, then that's a variation on what the book originally said. And the virus works the same way. So what viruses do is when they enter your system, like you inhale it, they seek out healthy cells and they attach to those healthy cells and invade them. Inside that cell, then, what they do is make copies of themselves, right? So if there's a copying error in that cell, that's then what emerges from that cell, and the process starts over again until you have a new variation of the virus circulating in the population. And with the Delta variant, that's exactly what we saw. It actually emerged out of India earlier this year because they had just a tremendous amount of cases, a lot of people being infected. So we saw a variation of the virus emerge out of there. And that's really an important point, because if we can keep people from being infected, we're less likely to get variants.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're mentioning that it first started in India. I remember reading articles about this, I don't know if it was a fungus or something that was also on a rise with folks having Delta. Are we seeing any of that here in the U.S.?
I haven't seen any of that. No, which is good news. But, you know, the concern is if we can get more people vaccinated, we slow down the rate of transmission of the disease itself, which means fewer and fewer people are being infected and able to spread the disease, which means then we cut down on the possibility of another variant emerging. And that's always been our concern in public health, is that we get a variant that the vaccine isn't as effective against.
Well, speaking of the effectivity of the vaccine, is the Delta variant, are vaccines as effective for the Delta variant as they've been for other ones?
It definitely seems fairly high at this point for all three of the vaccines, like in the 80 percentile, right? We know that no vaccines are perfect or 100%, but right now the vaccines that we have available seem very effective against the Delta variant.
Right. Well, Shandy, Thomas mentioned some of the breakthrough cases, and I'm sure a lot of people have seen and read about this. Can you sort of give us an idea of what that means when we hear breakthrough cases?
Sure. So a breakthrough case is when someone tests positive for COVID, even though they're fully vaccinated. So either they've had their two doses of their Moderna or Pfizer, or their dose of J&J, and enough time has passed that they should be fully vaccinated. And so what we're seeing are some breakthrough cases. That's not unexpected. We knew we would see that with any kind of vaccine. We see some breakthrough cases, but with most vaccines as well, if you do get diagnosed with COVID, the symptoms are much milder. you're a lot less likely to end up in the hospital. And we're not seeing mortality cases very often with a breakthrough case as well. Some of the studies are showing of those people who do die from COVID who have been fully vaccinated, they're almost always over 80 and they have comorbid conditions that make them more likely to die from COVID, unfortunately.
Should we be worried at all when we hear that the number of breakthrough cases are increasing?
It's definitely a sign for us to go ahead and mask up again. That's why CDC reversed their decision a few weeks ago. But I just want to point out that some of the headlines that we see might seem alarming. I know just recently I'd seen a headline that said 5,000 breakthrough cases in Massachusetts. But if you really go through and read the article, the state has 4.3 million people vaccinated. 80 of those breakthrough cases did die, unfortunately, from COVID. But if you do the math on that, that's 0.0018% of those people who were vaccinated. And so it's really unlikely that you're going to get hospitalized, even more unlikely that you will die from COVID if you get the vaccine. So just like the flu vaccine, sometimes you get the flu vaccine and sometimes you still get flu, but you're not nearly sick. You don't end up in the hospital, and fortunately, you're able to survive and go on. And that's what we're seeing, too, with the COVID vaccine.
I think there's somehow this misconception that folks had that the vaccine was like this golden ticket and you'd never, ever get infected, even though, as you said, if you did test positive for COVID, you're likely to be less sick than somebody who hasn't been vaccinated.
Right. Well, I agree. We all, you know, have a lot of hope on this vaccine. And I just want to say that these vaccines are still very effective. I mean, they're more effective than a lot of other vaccines that we have for other diseases in the U.S. And we use them on a regular basis. But the key there is that enough people get vaccinated on a regular basis that we keep the transmission down. So we don't see a lot of outbreaks now in the U.S. of measles, mumps, rubella. But that's because we all get vaccinated as kids and we keep those vaccines up as adults when need it, when we do have an outbreak. And we need to get to that stage now with COVID. We all need to get those vaccines to stamp out some of the transmission.
Right. I'm thinking about just as a kid getting chickenpox, and now there's the vaccine. I'm like, I really wish I didn't have to get chickenpox.
Oh, me too. I went through that too. I was too old to have the vaccine, so I got the real thing, and I would have much rather had one more shot.
Right. Well, if you're listening live and you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Thomas, have you noticed anything about the way breakthrough cases are being covered or talked about? Maybe anything that really concerns you?
So it's always been kind of this, especially when somebody famous gets a breakthrough case, right? We see it. We saw like a football coach recently announced that he had a breakthrough case of disease after being fully vaccinated. Shandy's right that those are going to occur because the vaccine isn't perfect. And we have these variants that act a little bit differently upon the vaccine. But I think the most important follow-up to this is that he wasn't hospitalized. He had very mild symptoms, was able to convalesce at home and get better, and is now back to work because he was vaccinated. If he were unvaccinated, that might be a very different story, right? So I think that's kind of the follow-up piece that we should be seeing more of and more talking about that point as opposed to breakthrough disease, is that we can recover fairly quickly without hospitalizations and mortality.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And, you know, I think sometimes when folks are reading about what's going on with the global pandemic, it's kind of tough to figure out with statistics and numbers and, you know, what does that all really mean? Do you have any advice for folks when they're taking in this information?
Yeah, I would definitely look to what I would call reputable sources, things like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, your local or state health department's website, or even the World Health Organization, right, to get that. And recognize that these numbers change daily, right? And you have to understand how they're counting cases, or are they calculating a rate for that? So I would stick with reputable sources and have some sort of monitoring daily if you want. Like, those are things that I do every day. I just take a quick look at a couple of different websites that I trust and just see which direction are we going. Some of the graphs, like on the State Department of Health website, are really informative to identify a trend. Are we going up? Are we leveling off? Are we going down? Those are important pieces. But what Shandy indicated is now is not the time to let your guard down. Even if it looks like we're leveling off or starting to go down in cases, that's because we're being vaccinated and we're wearing masks again.
When you mentioned sort of looking at the CDC and some of these reputable sources, it makes me wonder, you know, sometimes I'll see things that will say this area is substantial or high or low. How do you figure out, like, if you go into a community, if it's a high transmission? I'm just saying for myself, a non-medical person, like, how do I interpret that? Do I just say, oh, that says high, I shouldn't go there?
Yeah, so that's based on some sort of positivity rate, right? How many people are testing positive over the number of tests given, right? So then that gives us, well, a percent positive of the population. And, you know, our goal in Indiana was to be below 5%. So when we start seeing 7, 8, 9, 10% positivity, that tells us that transmission is high. Right. And that could be from a number of things, including people not being vaccinated, not wearing masks, and congregating when they shouldn't be.
Well, Shandy, when it comes to the CDC and its messaging, do you think they've done a good job or should they have been focusing on doing a better job?
I've got to say, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but unfortunately, I think there have been a couple of missteps. So I think a lot of us in public health are in agreement that the message about taking off the masks was not taken the way they intended it. So I think CDC tried to use the whole idea of if you're vaccinated, you can take off your mask as the carrot. And unfortunately, we did not have enough people vaccinated yet. And what we saw was everyone took off the mask, whether or not they were vaccinated. I know if I went to the local grocery store, I saw 5 or 10% of the people wearing a mask, even though I know in my area, only 50% of the people are vaccinated. So I know there's some lots of unvaccinated people out there not wearing a mask when I'm out in public. And so that approach obviously did not work. They really wanted to push the positive side of getting vaccinated, and it just wasn't enough. We need to have those conversations with people. I think access has been pretty well solved for most people, not for everyone right now with vaccine. I mean, you can go into your local store, a pharmacy, your local health department. A lot of providers around Indiana now have the vaccine in their offices. So the vaccine is available. It's still free. But unfortunately, people just aren't getting that push to go get vaccinated. And so they need to take the time. What we're seeing is more success when some of these larger employers have the mandates, just because you can capture a chunk of people at a time. And also when we take the vaccine to employers, employees report they're just more likely to go ahead and get it. It's right there in front of them. The expectation is kind of there that they get it, so they get it done. They don't have to make an appointment, go find a new clinic site, anything like that. So we need to have those conversations to convince those people to go ahead and get vaccinated.
We have a question from Sarah on Facebook who asks, what are people saying about immunity after having COVID-19? Do you still need to get the vaccine, or do you have a 6 to 8 month window of immunity and then it significantly decreases?
So what we know currently is that there is some immunity after being actively ill. What we don't know is the exact time length of how long that window is to have what we would consider full protection, right? With where you have enough antibodies to fight off another infection. So the advice right now from public health officials and medical community is to, even if you have had active disease, you still need to be vaccinated, because we know that the vaccine helps protect against things like the Delta variant, whereas your previous infection may not offer that level of protection.
If you've had COVID before and then you get the Delta variant, would it hit you harder?
We don't really know that yet. There's not a lot of information around that, but we know that it's possible. We've had people be reinfected, and every time there's a variant, that possibility goes up.
Well, Thomas, what are your thoughts on, you know, we talked a little bit about the CDC and the messaging. It can often make people feel like, well, now I can't trust anyone because they keep going back and forth. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so Shandy brings up some really good points, and it's important to have consistent messaging across all sectors of the media and the communication industry itself. But I think that, you know, that to me is probably the hardest part, because we have different websites and different things we're looking at. So everybody's kind of saying different things, but we definitely need that messaging to be consistent and recognize that, you know, the science changes. As we learn more about these variants or about this disease, we're going to update the science and the recommendations for that. It's not that we're changing the message. What we're doing is updating the message to reflect what currently the science knows about this.
Well, when it comes to user-friendly resources, Shandy, what's the best place or ways for listeners to keep track of COVID infections around them if they're interested in doing that?
So again, as Tom pointed out, use a reputable source. So the Indiana State Department of Health has done a great job actually of visualizing cases. So if you play around on their vaccine dashboard, you can look at what areas are well vaccinated, which ones are not. Same thing for the case count. You can look at positivity rate. You can look at deaths reported in the area. You can look at the total number of people getting tested. So you can kind of see where those waves are hitting. And fortunately, we've got a few counties now in Indiana under the red status on the Indiana dashboard because the positivity rate is going up too quickly.
Thank you so much. Shandy Durth is director of the Center for Public Health Practice at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. And Thomas Dzinski is the director of epidemiology education, also at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Coming up, we'll hear from an Indiana woman who has started her own fashion line, and we'll find out what it takes to get one going. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You're listening to the Friday Recap on All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's the Friday Recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. Coming up, we will hear from a local designer about what it's like to start and run a fashion brand in Indiana. With us is Indiana fashion designer Jennifer Feltz, owner of Tokyo Twiggy and the winner of the 2019 Emerging Designer Competition for Indiana Fashion Week. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Jennifer, you're here in Indiana, and you went to school at the Art Institute of Indiana. How did you end up here?
I'm originally actually from Dallas, Texas. I moved here about 9-10 years ago. My dad had a new job change and was relocated up here, and schools were cheaper up here. So it was definitely a smarter move on my end to be able to come up here. So it actually all ended up working out for the best.
Yeah. Well, Indiana's probably better than Texas, right? We're just going to say that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, your brand Tokyo Twiggy, can you tell us a bit about it and how you even started with this brand?
Yes. So my brand is called Tokyo Twiggy. I originally came up with my brand idea through school. My brand is a streetwear, custom streetwear brand that it focuses on comfort and style. So everything that I have is meant to be comfortable, but it also to help to be able to stand out and be more individualistic. And my brand, I do everything from, I do custom, so custom textiles. I can make my own textiles for people. It also includes anything, both men's and women's wear. I am introducing swimwear soon too as well. Eventually I want my brand to be all inclusive. So I want it to be men's, women's, plus size, anything in between. And so I've just been slowly building that up. So I'm having my second menswear collection coming out here soon as well, as well as with my swimwear. So pretty excited about all that.
That sounds like a lot of work too. I mean, is it hard to start a brand if you don't know anything about fashion?
It is. It is very, I'm learning stuff new every day, and I'm learning the limits to my abilities every day. But at the same time, it's also because it changes so much. It's like is so exciting, and it's always something. I always love learning new things. So, and it's hard to stay bored when things are always changing. Technology always changes. The fashion industry never stays the same. So it always keeps me on my toes. So even though it's hard, it's definitely very rewarding and definitely worth every second of it.
I love that you're saying it changes and it keeps you challenged all the time. It's making me feel like I need to switch careers, because I love the idea of learning new things all the time and challenging myself. So that's really cool. You know, you have this background as a designer, and you're starting this brand, and it's difficult, even for someone like you that's a professional. Where do you get your inspiration from to continue pushing forward?
My inspiration really can come from almost anything, but a lot of it comes from traveling. So I have done a lot of traveling in the past, and I'm hoping as things open up more to do some more traveling, but I do get a lot of inspiration through traveling and through people I meet and experiencing new things or cultures. And a lot of the times my inspirations or concepts can be multiple things. So I could be inspired by something like city lights, but then want to do more of a cyberpunk, or make it something. I always try to make like several things try to fit together, so it's not just like straight like black and white, or it's just inspired by this, or it's like a whole mood, I guess, a whole vibe. But I try to always keep myself inspired by trying to always learn new different things, trying to try new things. Those are the things that always keep me in my creative space.
Mm-hmm. And what's made you remain in Indiana with your brand versus branching out and going to somewhere like New York?
Mainly the cost of living here. And with that, because I'm able to afford not only living in an apartment, but owning my own studio, I was able to purchase like all my industrial machines and stuff like that a lot easier doing that here than trying to go to New York. And I wouldn't be able to afford any of that, only barely rent. And with the world constantly changing and retail changing as well, it's not really necessary to have like a storefront or anything. You can be based out of anywhere, and your customers can still be from like LA or New York, but you're living in Indiana. So it makes it really convenient in that way, being able to have those type of resources here where I don't necessarily have to worry too much as financially, but still be able to have my products out of Indiana as well. So there's really no comparison, I guess, per se. So it makes it really nice to be able to do all that.
Yeah. And I'm actually taking a look real quick at your website right now. And I love just the aesthetic and the colors. And you have masks. You have custom masks here.
Yes, I do. I have done the custom mask. It was a great thing to do during the pandemic. Something I've never done before, and doesn't seem to be going out of style anytime soon. So it works out.
Yeah. And tell me about, you were saying about having your own textiles made, you weren't finding the fabrics, so you were having them made. What is that process like?
So for me, I know different designers or different textile designers is different for them, but for me, I do all my work digitally. So I use anything from, right now, currently I use Procreate and Photoshop and Illustrator, and I usually use a combination of all those, and I make my textiles that way. And then I have it printed here locally in Brownsburg at a place called 66 Apparel, and they've been really helpful with me with the process, because a lot of it I've had to self-teach myself. So there's been a lot of mistakes, but they've also been able to help me through the process of figuring it out. But yeah, it's all digitally. Makes it really easy to really, there's no limits but my own imagination. So that really helps, instead of being able to have to sit there and spend hours on websites trying to find a fabric and hope that it's right.
That's really cool to be able to make your own fabric from your vision and see it come to life. What does it feel like when you actually see your idea come to fruition?
The actual process of getting to that point can cause me a lot of anxiety. I feel like a lot of like creatives, they're the worst enemy. So it's like, I don't know, is this too bold? Is this too I mean, obviously when you do stuff on the computer, you know, it's very small, but then when you print it like on a garment, on a dress, it's a whole lot bigger, obviously. So it's like, is this too much? Is this whatever? But once it's actually printed and it's in my hands, there's like a sense that it's just like, no one has this. Like, I personally made this from my own scratch. So it, there's like a certain feeling that it's just like, this is great. This is wonderful. I love doing this. I love being able to, I guess, control the creative process from the very beginning to the ending. But I mean, during the actual process itself can be a little overwhelming because it's like, I don't know if this will work out or not. But
Yeah. We're often our own worst critics. But I mean, that's got to be rewarding to be able to create something and tangible and hold it in your hands.
Oh, definitely. I wouldn't change it for anything.
You were the winner of the Emerging Designer Competition for Indiana Fashion Week in 2019. What was that like, and how did you decide to compete?
So I just graduated out of school, and I just printed my own textiles once. I did a small collection for my senior collection. And once I graduated, I started seeing posts for Indiana Fashion Week. Initially, I wasn't going to apply because I only had like a very small portfolio and I only printed my own fabric once. So I wasn't sure if I could even get in. And I don't think I actually applied until like the last day the applications came through or something like that. But I was like, well, I definitely don't get in if I don't try. So let's just try and we'll go from there. And to my surprise, I actually got in and I loved it. I loved being able to meet other people in the community that I have not met and to be able to see how expansive our community and how diverse it was. And so it was a very positive experience for me. So I didn't necessarily have to win. I was just excited to be there and excited for the opportunity and to be able to meet other people locally that could possibly help me with my next step and knowing what to do. And I was surrounded by other very talented designers. So I was just overall was just very pleased with the opportunity, and I was not expecting to win. And so when I won, I was definitely in a state of shock. I was definitely prepared for failure more than I was prepared for success. So a lot of what happened afterwards was like a whiplash, because I was like, holy crap, so I'm actually doing this now. I'm actually a designer. Like, it's not just like, you know, that little childhood dream, like, I want to be a designer or something. It's like actually was coming to be. And so it was very exciting, very rewarding. Better yet, that, like I said, I was not expecting to win, not even. I was just happy with the opportunity. So the fact that that happened to you was just like an extra bonus. So.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, just meeting other people. And it seems like this is such a great initiative to have this Indiana Fashion Week for designers to network with each other and know that they're all around Indiana. It's like, yeah, we're here too. So did you feel that? Did you feel like you were able to meet other designers and folks from Indiana?
Oh yeah, for sure. While I was in school, I struggled finding, I would say, the creative community here in general. It is more smaller, but with it being small, it also means people are closer, the community is closer and more tight-knit. And so I wasn't sure on how to be able to network or to meet people, and especially to do it here in Indiana was something that I did struggle with while being in school. So when I did hear about Indiana Fashion Week and like how it would be able to connect towards other people and to be able to meet other designers, photographers, stylists, like everybody through the fashion industry in general was amazing. And to see the type of diversity here too, I was kind of like, where have you people been at this whole time? And it's like, so it was really cool and it was really great. And I've been able to collaborate with other designers or photographers or models and be able to do a lot of cool things just here locally that I probably would have never known about unless I did something like Indiana Fashion Week.
And, you know, hearing from you and hearing from Michael Weston of the Indiana Fashion Foundation, I feel like there's this energy. I can feel this sort of momentum growing for fashion in Indiana. And it seems like it's a really exciting time. Do you think that the future of fashion in Indiana is just getting started?
Oh, yeah. I think this is really just the beginning. And especially because we do have such a diversity that just, I don't see anything but good things coming from it. I mean, myself, even as a textile designer and my brand, it doesn't seem like it's a norm for Indiana or something that would come out of Indiana. And I can't tell you through my travels how many times people are like, oh, you're from like LA or something. I'm like, no, I'm actually based out of Indiana. And people being surprised that like there are brands that come out of Indiana that are unique that people don't typically see here. But I'm just one out of, like Michael said, over 100 different designers, and they all have their own particular niche that is still just as incredible. But we're always, it seems like we're always overlooked, but I don't think that's going to be for much longer.
And what is your favorite part about working in fashion? Is there anything that really you love more than other elements?
I do love, I always love being able to create, so that's always good. But I do love, as I mentioned before, how it is always changing, and I'm always learning something new, and every information, any bit of information, whether good or bad, is always something that helps me progress further as not only as a brand, but as an individual and as a designer as well. And in ways that I've been able to connect with a community that I've never had initially before. And it's really wholesome to be able to talk to even people who are customers of mine and why they like my stuff and why they wear my stuff and stuff that I, things that, you know, you're always your worst critic. So I was like, oh, no one's going to like my stuff or buy my stuff. And that wasn't the case at all. And so it's really happy to be able to create something like just from scratch, and then being able to see that people not only love it, enjoy it, and find ways to make it their own and find ways to use it to express themselves. So that's really neat.
Well, what's it like seeing someone wearing your collection if you happen to run into them somewhere?
It's very strange initially. But it's really exciting. And I've had models or photographers buy my stuff and use it in random shoots or that they do. And then I'll randomly get tagged in them being like, oh yeah, we bought this from Tokyo. And I was like, oh my gosh, look at how they're doing this. And it's really cool too, because I love seeing people being able to change my, or use my stuff to express themselves. So there'd be like people wearing stuff that I initially thought was going to be a skirt, and they made it into a top or like a corset thing instead. And I was like, I mean, that's not what I mean, it was a skirt, but I like this. This is better. I never thought about wearing it this way. And so it helps me like be able to see different sides of my own work that I have never thought about initially myself. So, and that really helps with the creative process later on while creating new garments for people.
That's really cool. And as we get ready to wrap up here, are there any collections you're working on that we can look forward to seeing?
Yes. So I have two collections coming up. I'll have one in August for Indiana Fashion Week, and that's my swimwear-based collection. And then in September, I will be doing London and Milan Fashion Week, and I will be having a collection of women's wear and men's wear for that.
And so are you traveling there to present your stuff?
I am.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited and very nervous, but it's going to be an amazing experience.
Well, congratulations on all that you're doing, and good luck with all of your upcoming projects.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jennifer Feltz, for joining us. She's the owner of Tokyo Twiggy and the winner of the 2019 Emerging Designer Competition for Indiana Fashion Week. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And if you ever want to leave us a message, a question, or a comment, you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Or you can check out our app. It's called All in Vox Pop. You can leave us a voice memo through that as well. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.